I just love seeing you all come in like this.
He's talking about the new refiners joining the Severed Patreon page. Just $5 a month and no cranial drill required. Go to patreon.com/severedpod.
Okay, you're all set.
Severed, the ultimate severance podcast.
Hey there, Refiner. Glad to have you back. We've got more fun planned for today, and I do mean fun. This is Severed, the Ultimate Severance Podcast. I'm your host, Alan S. It's time for Severed Origins to take a look at the 1999 comedy Office Space. Dan Erickson has mentioned it multiple times as an influence when it came to writing and creating Severance. Office Space captures the zombie-like atmosphere of cubicle land in the tech sector in the late 20th century. They may not be severed, but the gang at Inatech feels just as doomed by their jobs as any macrodat. As always, tons of spoilers ahead for the 1999 movie Office Space. Want to have a look before you listen? It's a quick and fun 90 minutes. You can stream Office Space from Max, or it can be rented from all the usual suspects. Be warned, it's a pretty hard R when it comes to language. During filming, word got out that 20th Century Fox wanted the producers to try for a PG-13 rating for the film. The cast took it upon themselves to make that almost impossible by amping up the number of F-bombs they dropped. Combined with the unedited gangster rap, it worked. They got the R. So if you're ready, Refiners, it's time to open the R-rated file called Office Space. Office Space is the first live-action movie from American Renaissance man Mike Judge. Judge was born in 1962 in Ecuador to an archaeologist father and librarian mother. Judge was raised from the age of 3 in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He is primarily an animator, but he's also been known to act, play bass, make hilarious and weird TV shows, and churn out the occasional animated feature. If you're not a fan but think you've heard the name, it's probably because of Beavis and Butthead. The 90s-era skewering of the MTV generation was Judge's breakthrough. The original B&B short from 1992, called Frog Baseball, led to the creation of the MTV series. Judge voiced both main characters and many of the supporting characters. He also wrote and directed the whole thing. Judge's sly societal observations came through even more strongly in his next big series, King of the Hill. Judge co-created the animated sitcom with Greg Daniels from The Simpsons and Office fame. Hank Hill and his cohorts lived in the fictional town of Arlen, Texas, based strongly on Garland, Texas, where Judge had lived. The series would run starting in 1997 for 13 seasons. Judge voiced both the lead, Hank Hill, and his neighbor, conspiracy-obsessed Dale Gribble. Judge proved himself to be an entertaining mirror of society. He was equally adept at presenting believable stoner rockers watching videos on a couch, or a hard-working, very conservative propane salesman in Texas. Judge could, through his animations, both skewer and elevate unique characters and relatable societal situations. Much like Dan Erickson's story about wanting to turn off his brain before going into a soul-crushing job, Office Space grew out of a couple of jobs Judge had worked in the 1980s. He was an engineer at Parallax Graphics, a San Francisco-based tech company, for about 3 months. He said it was at the height of the yuppie overachiever era, and it was pretty horrible. The other job was a temp position where he had to perform the mind-numbing task of alphabetizing purchase orders. Based on these two experiences, Judge created the Milton series of 4 animated shorts starting in 1991. Milton was a mild-mannered and constantly put-upon office drone. His boss was the clueless and heartless Bill Lumberg. The first Milton short is about 2 minutes. It is almost identical to a scene in this movie. Judge even called the series Office Space featuring Milton. The first short established the Milton character, his stapler, his anger at being constantly moved around, and his oft-repeated threat about burning down the building. The only difference between the short and what we see in the movie is a detail about the stapler. In the animation, it's not red. The 4 Milton shorts aired on Liquid Television and then Saturday Night Live in the early and mid-1990s. Peter Chernin, head of 20th Century Fox at the time, wanted to make a feature based on the Milton character. Judge had just proven he could deliver by completing the animated feature Beavis and Butthead Do America. It was a nice offer, but Judge didn't think Milton was strong enough a character to carry a movie. Someone else in the meeting suggested he do more of an ensemble, like the movie Car Wash, only at an office. Judge wrote a treatment in 1996 for a live-action look at the world Milton inhabits. 20th Century Fox CEO Tom Rothman loved The Draft. He was looking for lighter fare after heavy event movies like Titanic. Rothman called Judge's script for Office Space the most brilliant workplace satire he'd ever read. Milton was moved to the background. He became a minor but important character brought to brilliant life by Stephen Root. Even though Judge had completed an animated feature, he didn't know anything about live-action filmmaking. He said it was the film's director of photography, Tim Sirstedt, who helped him make the transition. Sirstedt taught Judge about lighting, lenses, and even where to put the camera. Principal photography began in Texas in May of 1998. The movie would come out in February of 1999. Just a guess, but I don't think Dan Erickson saw this one in the theaters when it came out. For one thing, it was a commercial dud at the time of release. It only grossed $12 million on a budget of $10 million. There are a couple of other reasons I don't think Dan saw this thing when it came out. For one, he had just turned 15 at the beginning of 1999. This is an R-rated movie. You have to be 17 to get in without a parent. Which, sure, it's not hard to sneak into an R-rated movie, but even if it wasn't restricted, what 15-year-old wants to waste a night out at the movies on an office-based comedy? I don't see it. Also, 1999 was a solid year for cinema, especially if you were a teenager. I think Dan was probably spending his entertainment budget on things like The Mummy, Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, The Sixth Sense, The Matrix, and Star Wars Episode I, among many other huge 1999 releases. I don't see a 15-year-old handing over his $7 to watch three 20-somethings complaining about their tech jobs. I'm betting Dan found Office Space when the rest of us did in the early 2000s. Comedy Central first aired Office Space in August of 2001. Over the course of the next 2 years, they would air it 35 times. With that much exposure, cult status for the film was definitely a lock. Office Space sold well on DVD and home video. Between the Comedy Central airings and big word of mouth, the popularity was growing. 4 years after the movie's release, Judge was working on the script for his movie Idiocracy with a writing partner in Austin, Texas. They took a break one day at a local Starbucks. The baristas were doing Lumberg lines as they worked. Judge's friend asked him if they were doing the lines because Judge was in the building. About that time, one of the baristas turned to them and asked if they knew the movie Office Space. He explained how it was a favorite with the Starbucks staff. The barista had no idea he was talking to the writer-director. Although the general public would eventually turn Office Space into one of Fox's highest-grossing and most consistent sellers on DVD, the critics were on the harsh side when it first came out. Owen Gleiberman from Entertainment Weekly gave it a C, saying it felt cramped and underimagined. Later, EW would do an about-face, including Office Space at number 73 on a list of the 100 best films from the 25-year period 1983 until 2008. That year, they would also rank it fifth on a listing of the 25 greatest comedies from the same 25-year period. Roger Ebert gave it 3 out of 4 stars. USA Today was a bit nicer than most, writing, "If you've ever had a job, you'll be amused by this paean to peons." The Rotten Tomatoes Critics Aggregator does list it as fresh. It got a quite respectable 80% on the tomato meter based on 102 professional critics' reviews. It should be noted, most of those were written well after the movie's theatrical release. More than 250,000 audience scores have ranked it with a very solid 93%. In the legacy section of the Office Space Wikipedia entry, the very last line reads, "The film was an influence on the creation of the TV show Severance." So, Refiners, are you ready to find out just how a comedy about stealing fractional cents, destroying office equipment with a baseball bat, or the amount of flair you're wearing at work could influence a dystopian sci-fi drama like Severance? Let's push play, shall we? We open in traffic. Where are we? Actually, we're in Texas, but you'd never know it. This is the Lyndon B. Johnson Expressway. It's not an interstate, but it is a very busy 3-lane road around Dallas. Check the license plates. They very intentionally don't have a state identifier on them. Judge wanted the Inditex location to be very corporate and very anonymous. This movie could be happening in any town where the tech boom was taking hold. Judge had noticed that throughout the country, the 90s saw this rise of isolated office parks loaded with huge, modern-looking office buildings. These sprawling corporate cubicle farms would spring up out on the edge of town. Since they were so far from an urban center, these sprawling commercial parks included fountains, green spaces, and usually there'd be a block of chain restaurants situated somewhere nearby. You could walk into a Chili's or a TGI Fridays in any one of these concrete bastions of commerce, and they all felt about the same from region to region. Filming started in May of 1998, according to cinematographer Tim Sirstedt. There were fires in Mexico at the time that were making the Texas skies white. They had to keep postponing the shoot for this traffic sequence until the fires died down. Behind the wheel of a nondescript brown Econobox is our hero, Peter Gibbons, being played by Ron Livingston. Ron's an American actor originally from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He was born in 1962. His first IMDb entry came in 1992 for the Dolly Parton comedy Straight Talk. Since then, Ron has racked up 100 IMDb credits. One of his biggest roles was in the 2017 through 2020 series Loudermilk. He notched 30 episodes as the title character. He also won a 2002 Golden Globe for his performance in 2001's Band of Brothers. Ron is still working with four projects just coming out in 2023. Interestingly, Ron was not the first choice for this character, at least not the studio's first choice. They wanted Judge to go for the newly hot team of Ben Affleck and Matt Damon to be in this movie. They specifically wanted Damon to play Peter. Thankfully, Ron Livingston's manager had contacted casting director Nancy Klepper before any decisions were made. Ron says he felt like he killed it on the audition, using all of Nancy's desk drawers as props. When Nancy sent the tape of Ron over to Mike Judge, she included a note that said, "You're not gonna believe this guy." It only took a few minutes of watching for Judge to know he had his Peter. Nancy said there was just something about Livingston's cadence that caught the humor of Judge's writing. Judge did go ahead and meet with Matt Damon. According to Mike, Damon was really nice and really liked the script, but he had no chance when it came to reading. Judge already had his Peter, and it was definitely Ron. The traffic jam introduces Peter to us as unhappy, put upon, and fed up with his life. He doesn't need to say a word, but we get it. Judge said some of the earliest notes from the studio wanted Peter to smile more. Judge was shocked. How could this obviously unhappy person be smiling? He told them to hold on. Peter will smile later, but for a big chunk of the movie, he is not a happy guy. Livingston said studio suits accused him of being on drugs because his performance was so listless. Listless was exactly what Judge wanted. The director ignored the notes and had Livingston continue to act like he was on drugs. One of the many negative reviews said Office Space felt like a loosely related bunch of skits. Each was some kind of a gag to deliver. I would have to say, duh, to this observation. Every comedy is a bunch of gags hung on a narrative. In this scene, the gag is how slow traffic is around this office park. Peter notices an elderly man using a walker on the sidewalk. As Peter moves back and forth between lanes looking for the one that's moving, he notices the walker guy is pulling out ahead of the pack of traffic. The chipper music being played over this scene is Mambo No. 8 by Perez Prado. Uno, dos, tres, cuatro, cinco, seis, siete, ocho, Mambo! The soundtrack utilizes a number of tunes from various periods, but it also includes a lot of gangsta rap. We'll get to the fight over the rap numbers in just a bit. According to the alternate versions section of IMDb, the soundtrack in the theatrical release of the film is in a different sequence than how it appears on the DVD. No word as to how it changed, if this is even accurate, or why. After Peter realizes he'd be better off walking to work, we cut to another featureless Econobox of a car sitting in the same traffic jam. The music transitions. Now we're hearing American rapper Scarface with a tune from his 1994 album, The Diary. This cut is called No Tears. Scarface is about as raw as they come when it comes to gangster rap. The guy in the car who knows every word is Dave Herman. He's playing the character of Michael Bolton, and no, not that Michael Bolton. Dave Herman was the only member of the cast Mike Judge knew he wanted in advance. He wrote the Michael Bolton character specifically with Herman in mind. Judge had worked with Herman extensively on King of the Hill, where he was a utility voice actor on 153 episodes. Herman's big break came in 1995 when he was cast as one of the original eight on Fox's Mad TV. Herman was a versatile performer who played dozens of original characters and landed some great impersonations. It seemed like a great gig, but after two seasons of the show, Herman was starting to get outside offers. The problem? Mad TV and Fox wouldn't let any of the cast out of their very restrictive contracts so they could pursue other projects. Additionally, Herman was a valuable part of the show, delivering some of the most popular segments. Most of the cast just quit. Herman chose to get himself fired. The story goes he yelled all of his lines during a table read. When he wouldn't stop yelling, they fired him. They also told him he'd never work in this town again. Well, this was in the fall of 1997. Judge told him not to worry. Mike had plenty of work for Herman on King of the Hill. Then he offered Herman the Office Space role. In some places, you'll see it reported that Herman got himself fired so he could take the Office Space role. This isn't exactly right according to the timeline I was able to piece together. Herman quit possibly as much as a year before he would have been offered the Michael Bolton role. He was quitting Mad TV so he could work with Judge, just not on this specific project. Herman really enjoyed the voice work he had done on animated shows like King of the Hill, Futurama, and Bob's Burgers. In addition to his 153 Hill episodes, he voiced 117 episodes of Futurama, and he appeared in 152 episodes of Bob's Burgers. Although he does get on screen now and then, most of Herman's 97 actor entries on IMDb are for voice work. If you're catching the Scarface lyrics, you can tell this cut was never on the radio. Apologies if you're using the closed captioning. They do write out every word. Herman is singing along at the top of his lungs. He knows every word. This was Judge's original vision, to have these very white, very nerdy engineers be heavily into hardcore gangsta rap. It was something he'd observed frequently while in Silicon Valley. These dorky, awkward engineers were the last people you'd ever imagine being into it, but they were all jamming out to hardcore rap with uncensored lyrics about gun violence, misogyny, and drugs. The studio execs, no surprise, hated the song selected for the soundtrack. Tom Rothman told Judge to pull the gangsta rap and go with something more mainstream. Judge was very adamant about keeping the rap in, but he is also a negotiator. Rather than get into a fight, he told Rothman if the next focus group doesn't like it, he'll take it out. Thankfully for Judge, some 19-year-old kid in the next group said he really liked how these office guys listen to hardcore rap. Rothman told Judge he wins, the rap stays. Judge makes it sound like this one kid made the difference, but actually, comments about the soundtrack were some of the most common positive comments they got from the focus groups. The truth of Bolton's gangsta tendencies are revealed when a black guy walks by in the standing traffic. He's selling flowers, wearing a straw hat and Bermuda shorts, but Michael casually reaches over to lock the car door. He also turns down his Scarface. It's okay to pretend you're gangsta as long as no true gangstas are anywhere around. Also, the repeated use of the N-word might not be the best thing to have blaring, especially in a nerdy white guy's car. Oh, and if you're wondering why he didn't just push a button, those are manual car locks. Back in the 90s, power locks and power windows were optional. Young guys buying their first car would probably have gone for the much cheaper manual option. When the very non-threatening black guy passes by, Michael turns it back up. I've got this killer up inside of me. I can't talk to my mother, so I talk to my diary. Another cut and another character introduction. We are in the car for 10 seconds with a vaguely Middle Eastern-looking man who is not happy. He's shaking his steering wheel and swearing at the top of his lungs. His cussing includes the vocabulary and cadence of someone who only knows English as a second language.
Mother shit, that son of a ass! You! I just...
This is Samir. We'll meet him in a few minutes, hopefully after he's calmed down. We cut to an across-the-street look at a bus stop. The guy in glasses with the thermos really draws your attention, doesn't he? This is Milton, being played by Stephen Root. We'll meet him in a minute as well. While we're looking at this long shot, I'd like to point out a movie trope that used to drive my dad nuts. Dad was a carpenter and construction worker for 38 years. See the construction worker standing to the far left, holding his lunchbox and wearing his hard hat? It's the hard hat. Dad said those things were hot and uncomfortable. Wearing them even gave you a headache. No actual construction worker wears his hard hat for a moment longer than OSHA rules force him to. You rip it off as soon as you're out of the hard hat area of the job site. According to Dad, nobody wears their hard hat to and from work. It shows up like this so often in movies because it's a great visual shorthand for identifying a character as a construction worker. We do get a little sample of Milton here. He just keeps mumbling to himself all the time. It doesn't matter if his audience knows what he's talking about or not. He just keeps talking.
I was told that if I was late again, I would be summarily dismissed.
We then get a look at Inatech with its endless brick facade and impressionist artwork. The thing on the pedestal that looks like part of a percent sign is a sculpture. It was common for tech companies of the era to commission local sculptors to create artwork for their office campuses. The Apple Park campus in Cupertino contains several massive and ambitious sculptures. Cut to the close-up of a reserved parking sign. This is the spot for Bill Lumberg, Division VP. Lumberg is another character that appeared in the Milton shorts. He was Milton's boss, also voiced in the shorts by Judge. In the movie, he's being portrayed by Gary Cole. We don't actually meet Bill just yet. First, we have to pan by his baby blue Porsche 911 with the highly annoying license plate MYPRSHE. When the camera gets around to the driver's door, we watch Bill emerge. He proves to be as annoying as his license plate. Bill is wearing a solid-colored shirt with a white collar and cuffs. This was really a style more from the 80s. The shirt could be anything, but the collar and cuffs were always white. Here, Bill's shirt is peach. He's also wearing suspenders and a belt. This is a detail from the animation. Lumberg likes to be ready for anything. As Bill gives his car a last admiring look, we get a nice shot of the Inatech sculpture. Inspiring, isn't it? A shot from out beyond the sign catches up with Peter. He's trudging across the Inatech lawn. It looks like the programmers park miles from where a division VP like Lumberg gets to park. The building Peter's approaching is located at 4120 Friedrich Lane in Austin, Texas. This building was used primarily for exteriors. Peter crosses the main Inatech lobby. He slows when he gets to a set of double doors. They have those metal butterfly handles like you see in office buildings everywhere. Peter hesitates. He's gotta do it. We've all had to do it at one time or another. After crossing the carpeted lobby, he reaches out and gets his solid static shock from the door handle. Peter enters cubicle land. The cubicles being used by Inatech were a special order for the production. Mike Judge wanted this office to be oppressive. They even screen tested multiple gray cubicles to get just the right level of you'll never escape. Judge wanted them high enough that Bill Lumberg had to lean into Peter's space. Judge didn't want it to be easy to talk over the top of the cubicle walls or for anybody to be able to see anything outside of their cubicle when they were seated. The style they went with looks like it features 62-inch walls with sturdy upper shelving and binder bins. Not that I spent too much time researching cubicles or anything. The natural sound of the cubicle corral is pretty funny. There are murmured voices, but there's almost a blip sound every so often. We can't tell what it is until Peter has his seat and looks across the aisle.
Corporate accounts payable, Nina speaking. Just a moment.
It's Nina and her perky phone answering phrase. Nina is a large woman with fiery red hair. The opening to her cubicle directly faces Peter. This is so spot on for any office. Everybody has their own phone answering phrase. Certain people are louder, and some are way more annoying than others. To add to the misery, Nina seems to be a gatekeeper, so she's constantly answering the phone.
Corporate accounts payable, Nina speaking. Just a moment.
Nina is being played by Kinna McEnroe, an actress, writer, and director originally from Levelland, Texas. This is Kinna's very first IMDb credit. She will go on to rack up 53 credits as an actress and voice performer. Kinna has appeared in a number of shorts. She even won a Best Actress nod at the Miami Underground Film Festival for her appearance in a 2007 short called The Suicide. Kinna just recently reprised her Nina role in a series of 2022 commercials for Walmart. The series featured everyone from Peter's next-door neighbor Lawrence to the real Michael Bolton, who's now working at Inatech. The series was to promote Walmart's Black Friday deals on Mondays, which, of course, led them to use the phrase Case of the Mondays. We'll get to more about that phrase in just a moment. According to an IMDb trivia item, Kinna recently lost more than 100 pounds. She has a Dutch boyfriend and spends a lot of her time in the Netherlands. Suddenly, without warning...
Hello, Peter. What's happening?
Ah, it's Bill Lumberg, one of Peter's 8 bosses and seemingly his most immediate superior. Lumberg is being played to perfection by the incomparable Gary Cole. Aside from Milton, Lumberg is one of the only other characters to appear in the original Milton cartoons. Judge also did the voice of Lumberg for the animation.
Oh, hello, Milton. What's happening? I'm going to need you to go ahead and move your desk again. So, if you could go ahead and just get it as far back into that corner as possible, that'd be terrific.
But Cole claims he got the part just by doing what Judge had done in the shorts. Judge disagrees. He says Cole took the part and made it 10 times funnier with his delivery. Cole's only attempt at comedy to this point in his career had been as Mike in the 1995 Brady Bunch movie. Cole found portraying Lumberg to be so easy because everyone could relate to that kind of annoyingly passive-aggressive authority figure. Casting director Nancy Klepper said as soon as Cole did one of those, yas in his audition, the room just broke. They knew they had their Lumberg.
We have sort of a problem here.
We get the feeling Bill only shows up when there is a problem.
Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS report.
He's so smarmy. Cole has created a slimy villain for the ages with Lumberg. Gary Cole was a working actor at the time, which meant a lot of his time was spent doing things other than acting. Cole regularly worked service jobs between acting gigs to pay the bills. He said it was about a year after the movie had been released when he knew they had a hit. Customers where he was bartending would do Lumberg lines back to him. People on the street were shouting, yeah. And let's talk TPS reports. This whole TPS thing comes from a cover sheet Judge actually encountered while working as an engineer. TPS in the software industry stands for Test Procedure Specification. It's a set of steps to be used when evaluating a given software feature. Judge said he intended TPS to stand for Test Program Set. The cover sheet was originally used by computer programmers to denote a version of a program being output for testing and review. In the movie, this has been changed a bit. The report itself is now called the TPS, and it needs a cover sheet. Sanford Panich, who was an executive vice president of Fox at the time, said he remembers a number of discussions about making the TPS reports, quote, look real. Even though TPS reports were something they really had created for the movie. In general society, TPS has come to denote pointless, mindless paperwork. The TPS report spawned by Office Space is now business shorthand for a meaningless exercise imposed upon employees by an inept and uncaring management. TPS references have appeared dozens of times on television and in the movies. King of the Hill, duh, Lost, The Mandalorian, and Rescue Me have all made very pointed references to TPS reports. In the NCIS episode called Starting Over, Gary Cole plays a character who, well, just give a listen.
What I'd give to never have to file another TPS report.
You do know it's a TBS report, right? Transbureau Synopsis.
What'd I say?
A TPS report.
Ah, old habits. Weird.
Cole then takes a very Lumberg-like sip of coffee. In the hilarious 2003 Super Bowl commercial, Terry Tate, office linebacker, Terry is also in on policing that TPS usage.
You know you need a cover sheet on your TPS reports, Richard. That ain't new, baby.
Hey, Terry.
Hey, Janice.
Peter assures Bill he's aware it was a simple mistake.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about that. I forgot.
Lumberg ignores this and keeps going, talking to Peter like he's a 3-year-old.
Yeah. You see, we're putting the cover sheets on all TPS reports now before they go out.
Lumberg looks puzzled, wondering how Peter doesn't understand.
Did you see the memo about this?
Yeah, he did. He just forgot.
But it's not shipping out till tomorrow, so there's no problem.
In this one interaction, we begin to understand the curse of Lumberg. He doesn't listen to anything.
Yeah. If you could just go ahead and make sure you do that from now on, that would be great.
Yeah, Bill, we got it.
And I'll go ahead and make sure you get another copy of that memo.
He's got one. Why would he need another one? Bill then says one of his favorite words.
Okay.
It's not okay, it's mm-kay. They even write it as mm-kay in the closed captioning. It's so annoying.
Okay.
There's a great Easter egg in this scene. See the ring Gary Cole's wearing on his right hand? It's gold with a red setting. This is a piece of costuming from another character. Just before landing Lumberg, Cole had been the lead on the single-season TNT sci-fi series Crusade. As Captain Matthew Gideon, Cole's character had completed his training at Earth Force Academy. What Lumberg's wearing is Gideon's class ring from the Academy. Peter again tries to explain he's got the memo right here. He really doesn't need another copy. Too late. The mighty Lumberg has already moved on to the next cubicle. We hear him greeting Phil. As Peter is rereading the TPS memo, we start to be aware of a radio broadcast playing somewhere nearby. Peter stands up to look over at Milton, who's in one of the adjoining cubicles. Milton has a very 80s-looking boombox sitting on the edge of his desk. He's listening to talk radio, but he's allowed.
I was told that I could listen to the radio at a reasonable volume from 9 to 11.
Yeah, no, I know you're allowed.
Milton is being played by prolific American character actor Stephen Root. Root was born in Sarasota, Florida in 1951. He began his exceptional career in 1988 when he appeared as a DEA agent in Crocodile Dundee 2. Root has compiled an incredible list of more than 280 credits on IMDb. Over half of those are voice credits. Those entries also represent hundreds of episodes of television, like 97 episodes of News Radio, 32 episodes of Barry, and 258 episodes of King of the Hill, just to name a few examples. On King of the Hill, he voiced Bill Dotrieve and Buck Strickland on a regular basis and provided other voices as needed. Root says he also took his cue from Milton from Judge's work on the original shorts. He added a bit more lisp and made the voice a bit spookier. Root did make one big change to the character, which I appreciated. The animated Milton was a fairly dedicated nose picker. Root manages to capture all the insanity and creepiness of Milton without mining his nostrils. Milton is based on a real guy Judge worked with while he was an engineer. One day after Judge asked this guy how he was doing, he started talking about how he was going to quit because he'd been forced to move his desk around too many times. He maybe didn't say anything about burning down the building, but the vibe was there. Peter was hoping Milton could maybe turn the radio down as a personal favor. Milton doesn't get it.
I told Bill that if Sandra's going to listen to her headphones while she's falling, then I should be able to listen to the radio while I'm collating. Uh-huh. So I don't see why I should have to turn down the radio because
I
enjoy listening at a reasonable volume.
Thanks.
There's no reasoning with Milton. Peter gives up and sits back down in his cubicle. Just as he's settling back in...
Hi, Peter. What's happening?
Hey, it's Dom Portwood, another one of Peter's 8 bosses.
We need to talk about your TPS reports.
Peter tells him Bill already mentioned it.
Yeah. Did you get that memo?
Peter starts to talk faster, explaining. He knows it was just the one time. It'll never happen again. He has the memo.
I've already taken care of it, so it's not even really a problem anymore.
It's like Dom doesn't even hear him either. It must be a trait of middle managers. Dom goes into the same explanation about covering those TPS reports. When he's done going over what Lumberg had already gone over, he whacks Peter hard on the back.
That'd be great. All right.
Dom is being played by American actor Joe Bays. Joe was born in Pahrumph, Nevada in 1955. He started his acting career in 1991 with a TV movie. Joe's had 40 credits since then. Most of his appearances are guest shots on TV series. His most recent came in 2023 as a clerk on an episode of The After Party. The phone rings. It's another boss checking in. Guess what about?
I have the memo.
We cut to an office printer with multiple feeder trays. Samir, who we saw cursing and mad in the car, is also not too happy with the printer.
Why does it say paper jam when there is no paper jam?
Samir Samir is being played by Ajay Naidu. Ajay's heritage is India, but he's American through and through. Ajay was born in 1972 in Evanston, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. One of his earliest on-screen appearances came in 1985. He portrayed a terminally ill 12-year-old in an ABC after-school special called No Greater Gift. Since then, Ajay has racked up nearly 100 IMDb credits. His most recent was in the 2023 movie The Magnificent Myersons, and he has two projects upcoming. Ajay also reprised his role as Samir for the 2022 Case of the Mondays Walmart ads. Mike Judge says he'd originally written the character of Samir as Iranian. Once Samir was cast, Judge sat down with Ajay to discuss what he would be comfortable with as a nationality. It was decided Samir would be from Jordan. Ajay wanted to make sure the character didn't sound Indian, so he worked with an Arabic dialect coach to get the accent just right. The battle with the printer is nothing new.
I swear to God, one of these days I just kicked this piece of shit out the window.
Michael Bolton, also now settled into his cubicle, agrees. On Bolton's cubicle wall, we see a poster of Snoop Doggy Dogg promoting his second album, 1996's The Dog Father. He also has a poster for the U.S. military SEAL team. Samir rips a chunk of paper out of the printer's platen. A heavy-set woman with reddish-brown hair walks up to Samir and Michael's cubicle cluster.
Sam, Iyer, Naga.
She's a temp. This is the first time she's come across Samir's name, and it's a bit of a stumper. Samir just takes the paper and lets her off the hook before she embarrasses herself anymore.
Michael Bolton?
That's me.
The temp is impressed. She asks if that's his real name. Oh, it is, and it's pretty obvious he's not happy about it.
So are you related to that singer guy?
Back away, lady. You do not know how badly you are poking the bear. Michael is suppressing rage.
No, it's just a coincidence.
Both of these guys have some real issues with their names.
No one in this country can ever pronounce my name right.
He says it's not that hard.
Nai-i-nanajad.
Okay, let me give it a try. Nagi Nanajar. Yeah, it's a lot of syllables, though. Michael has his own problems. He really can't sympathize.
Yeah, well, at least your name isn't Michael Bolton.
Samir, being a good friend, tells him there's nothing wrong with that name. Michael agrees at least there wasn't anything wrong with that name.
Until I was about 12 years old, and that no-talent ass clown became famous and started winning Grammys.
And speaking of becoming famous, this line became one of the most famous to come out of the entire movie. Ass Clown was an ad-lib by Dave Herman. Originally, Judge had written the line, "No singing asshole," which they couldn't use. It implied Bolton didn't sing his own songs. Herman recalls he had just heard his girlfriend use the term ass clown the night before, and he thought it was pretty funny. He threw it in here as an alternate to what was written. This ad-lib changed the course of history. At least in the world of junior high-level insults. The term ass clown was actually added to Webster's Dictionary in 2018. Mike Judge was given credit as the developer of the term since he was the writer of Office Space, but it was really all thanks to Dave Herman and his hilarious ad-lib. What did the real Michael Bolton think about all this? According to Herman, when it first came out, Bolton hated it. It really got to him. Herman says, unfortunately for the comedy, he's heard Bolton doesn't take himself so seriously anymore. It's true, the real Michael Bolton has actually since embraced a lot of the humor coming at his expense. How much has he done an about-face on Office Space? Well, instead of Dave Herman appearing in the Walmart ads, it's the real Michael Bolton in a tie and nerdy glasses, who's now working at Inatech for the Case of the Mondays series.
Why don't you just go by Mike instead of Michael?
This would probably soften the comparisons.
No way. Why should I change? He's the one who sucks.
Peter appears at their cubicle. He's ready to step out for a coffee break, even though he just got here. Starting the day with 8 bosses riding your butt about a TPS report will do that to you.
I gotta get out of here. I think I'm gonna lose it.
Just as he says this, the temp who had trouble with Samir's name is walking back by. She throws out another of those iconic phrases made famous by Office Space.
Uh-oh. Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
She hilariously draws her lips down in a frown on the word Mondays. Mike Judge certainly didn't come up with this line. It can be found both in print and online prior to the release of the movie. It doesn't really matter if he came up with it or not. The point is, trite overused, no longer funny workplace phrases have been around since there were workplaces. I'd bet Scrooge asked working hard or hardly working more than once to Bob Cratchit. Judge codified this line. He pointed it out and put a spotlight on it. He said to the world, "This is annoying. If you have a working brain, this is torturous." Still, thanks to airheaded functionaries like our chipper temp, these phrases live on in workplaces throughout the country. The case of the Monday's temp is being played by Jennifer Jane Emerson. There's not a lot of bio information available about Ms. Emerson. Her only IMDb credit prior to this was doing background voices on 5 episodes of Beavis and Butthead. Since she lives in Texas, I'd say she's got a tie to Mike Judge. She didn't do anything after this until 2006, when she appeared in the movie Fat Girls, which also shot in Texas. Jennifer Jane only has 8 total performer credits on IMDb. 2 of those are shorts, 1 is a video game voice, and 1 is, of course, her appearance in the Walmart Case of the Mondays commercials. Even though she's not landing a lot of gigs, it looks like Jennifer Jane is still working. I found her agency resume. She's repped by the Linda McAllister Talent Agency in Waxahachie, Texas. Michael and Samir both give this Case of the Mondays phrase a look like something smells bad. We cut to the interior of chain restaurant Tchotchke's. This is a fictional restaurant created for the movie. Still, you've been to a place like Tchotchke's. TGI Fridays, Chili's, Applebee's, Ruby Tuesdays, and dozens of other fast casual restaurants just like this one dot the countryside. They serve high-calorie appetizers and reasonably priced entrees in a building jammed with old road signs, vintage toys, and charming bric-a-brac stuck to the walls. All that stuff, the little things sitting around on shelves, those are literally tchotchkes. The word is actually spelled T-C-H-O-T-C-H-K-E. At least that's one of the ways. There are a half dozen acceptable variations. Usually, any English spelling of tchotchke starts with a T and not a C. It's a Yiddish word, originally derived from the Slavic word for trinket. Tchotchkes are small items of bric-a-brac or miscellaneous items of interest or minor value. Some meanings also include cheap trinkets or souvenirs. The exterior of Tchotchke's is a building located on Great Hills Trail in Austin. It's currently a Chase Bank branch. The stand-in for the Tchotchke's interior in the movie was a local Austin restaurant at the time, known as the Alligator Grill. It was located on South Lamar Boulevard in Austin. Unfortunately, it appears the original Alligator Grill closed in 2009. As of 2019, it's known as the Baker Street Pub and Grill, and the interior has been entirely remodeled. Peter is talking about how this job is getting to him.
One of these days, it's just going to be like...
He then pantomimes firing a machine gun like he's shooting up the office just as the waiter approaches the table. The waiter weirdly fires right back.
So can I get you gentlemen something more to drink or maybe something to nibble on? Some pizza shooters, shrimp poppers, or extreme fajitas?
He caps this line with a huge open-mouthed grin. Somehow he's showing all of his teeth. This is Brian, your waiter at Tchotchke's. I hate the phrase, drank the Kool-Aid, but it applies so completely to Brian, I can't help it. He's into every aspect of his amazingly super cool job here at Tchotchke's. He's memorized the entire appetizer menu, the day's specials, and the cutesy names of the house cocktails. If you aren't already at least 80% as amped as he is, your dining experience is going to be tiring.
So can I get you gentlemen something more to drink or maybe something to nibble on? Some pizza shooters, shrimp poppers, or extreme fajitas?
Your Tchotchke's waiter Brian is being played hilariously by Todd Duffy. Todd was born in Raleigh, North Carolina, but moved to Texas at the age of 3. He started acting in 3rd grade. By 4th grade, he was doing professional theater in Houston. He moved from Houston to Dallas in junior high so he could start his film career. At the age of 16, Duffy starred in the 1990 film Across 5 Aprils, also known as Civil War Diary. He was playing a 9-year-old. The movie was made on a budget of $250,000, and word is, according to IMDb reviewers, it's not all that good. Office Space was Todd's 6th performer credit. He's notched 40 in the past 30 years, the most recent coming in 2021. Brian's overly chipper greeting is not returned. Peter says just coffee is fine.
Sounds like a case of the Mondays.
You can't get away from it. The table talk continues as Brian goes to put in the order. Peter wonders if they'll still be doing this, meaning Inatech, when they're 50.
It would be nice to have that kind of job security.
Peter just knows Lumberg is going to ask him to come in on Saturday. He doesn't want to.
I'm going
to
end up doing it because I'm a big pussy.
He says it's why he works at Inatech to begin with. Michael and Samir both deny the pussy moniker. Michael even sounds a bit threatening.
Fact, they're going to find out the hard way that I'm not a pussy if they don't start treating their software people better.
This is where he first mentions a virus. He claims he could program something that would rip Inatech off big time.
Big time.
We cut to a POV shot of a waitress being played by Jennifer Aniston. She's coming out of the kitchen with a plate in either hand. Although in a very supporting role, she is the star power in this movie. We'll meet her more formally in a little bit.
There she is.
Peter perks up. He cranes his neck, trying to get a better look. Samir says Peter is always talking about this girl.
If you're so obsessed with her, why don't you just ask her out?
Peter says he can't do that. He'd just be some asshole customer hitting on a waitress.
Besides, I'm still trying to work it out with Anne.
This is also our first mention of Peter's girlfriend, Anne. It sounds pretty serious, but he doesn't seem too thrilled about it. Things are rocky between he and Anne.
That reminds me. I'm not going to be able to play poker with you guys on Friday.
Anne wants Peter to see an occupational hypnotherapist. He then pauses and says sometimes he thinks maybe she's cheating on him.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Oh, what now? Peter wants to know what they mean by that. Michael brushes it off.
Nothing.
They think he should blow off the appointment, but he knows Anne will get pissed if he does. Besides, this guy might be able to help. Peter reminds them he did help Anne lose weight.
Peter, she's anorexic.
Yeah, I know. The guy's really good.
That might be a little too good. We cap the scene with both Michael and Samir giving Peter grief about his TPS reports.
Yeah. Didn't you get that memo?
We cut to a shot from across the Inatech front lawn. A heavyset engineer-looking guy in a tie and short-sleeved shirt is crossing towards us in a panic.
Hey, guys! Peter!
Is that Smakowski?
Samir!
What's he doing?
Oh, probably working on another heart attack.
The man approaching with the red face is Tom Smakowski, middle manager and devoted pessimist. Tom is being played by American actor Richard Riley from Menomee Falls, Wisconsin. Richard Riley is, without a doubt, the most prolific actor I've ever profiled, ever. I've been doing this podcast thing for about 4 years now. I've looked up a lot of actors in that time. I'm very impressed when I find a credit listing that stretches into the 300 appearances range. Usually someone with a career like that has been working for 50 years or they do almost exclusively voiceover work. During the WKRP Cast podcast, we profiled Ian Wolfe, who played the character Hirsch. His profile includes 306 entries, but his first credit was all the way back in 1934, and he worked consistently for nearly 60 years. Richard Riley started his career in 1977. In the past 46 years, Richard has racked up, you ready for it? 413 performer credits. He has 18 upcoming, with some of those completed but not released, and others still in post-production. Richard had 5 credits in 2023, 4 in 2022, and that's slowing down for him. In 2014, he had 19 credits. In 2013, there were 17. The year this came out, in 1999, it was one of 12 credits for Richard. He also did 4 TV movies, 4 other theatrical movies, and 3 TV series in 1999. No shade, but Richard may be going for quantity over quality. He does TV series and videos and TV movies, but most of his credits are for movies. Most of the movies he's done, I've never heard of. I don't think anyone has ever heard of a lot of this stuff. I don't even know how he finds some of these productions to audition. As for more mainstream fare, he was Deuce's dad in Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo. Recognizable projects in his listing are kind of rare. Many of these titles went straight to video and don't even have a single user review. Tom is rushing towards them, waving a memo about a staff meeting. He's convinced this is it for their jobs.
They're going to downsize Intertek.
Samir is trying to calm him down. How could he know that?
How do I know? They're bringing in a consultant. That's how I know.
Tom says the same thing happened at Initrode last year. They tell you to meet with these efficiency experts when actually you're interviewing for your own job.
I bet I'm the first one laid off.
Tom is already picturing himself down at the unemployment office.
Stand in line with those scumbags.
The crew crosses a big ditch. It's a grassy drainage ditch, which really is located southwest of the building being used for the Initech exterior. The website Then and Now Movie Location snapped a picture of this ditch in 2019. Somebody needs to trim those bushes to the left. They've grown up like crazy in the last 20 years. Back in Michael and Samir's cubicle, Peter and Tom are joining them to discuss the situation. Tom says there are people in this world who don't have to put up with this shit.
Like that guy that invented the pet rock?
Tom says if you're going to make $1 million, you have to use your mind to come up with a great idea like that. Hold on, like what?
You think the pet rock was a really great idea?
Tom says sure it was.
The guy made $1 million.
Actually, he most likely made more than $1 million, and he made those dollars in the mid-1970s. $1,000,000 would have the same buying power as $5.7 million in 2023. The guy who came up with the pet rock was an advertising executive, so he already had a pretty low opinion of the general public. His name was Gary Dahl. Gary got the idea while sitting in a bar listening to his friends complain about their pets. He figured the perfect pet would be one that didn't need to be walked, fed, potty trained, bathed, or any of the other responsibilities associated with a living, breathing pet. Gary decided a rock would be the perfect low-maintenance pet. They also wouldn't become disobedient, get sick, or die. Gary wrote a jokey 32-page manual full of gags and bad puns about caring for your new pet. This was most likely while he was sitting at the bar after a few martinis. Gary said it was easy to teach your new rock tricks like sit and stay. He also came up with a cardboard crate as packaging. It was designed to look like a pet crate. Breathing holes were die-cut around the top of the box, and straw bedding was placed in the bottom. The straw was free, and the rocks cost him about a penny apiece. Gary said the most expensive part of the whole thing was producing the custom box with the die-cut holes. He snuck the first printing run of the 32-page owner's manual in with a client's print job, so all he had to pay for there was the trimming and binding. The pet rock fad began in the fall of 1975. Over Christmas of that year, sales peaked. By February of 1976, the fad was pretty much over. People suddenly realized they were buying a rock for $4, and sales came to a standstill. Gary didn't care. He'd sold more than 1 million units and walked away from the venture a millionaire. He used a part of his pet rock lottery winnings to open a bar in downtown Los Gatos, California. It's called Carry Nations, after the prolific temperance movement founder. It's still there on Santa Cruz. Gary passed away in 2015, so I doubt he still owns it, but Carry Nations is listed on Yelp as one of the top 10 bars in Los Gatos. Tom's regaling the youngsters with his tales. He says he had a pet rock level idea a few years ago, or at least an idea he considers to be pet rock caliber. The guys are all facepalming. It looks like they've maybe heard this story before, but they politely go ahead and ask Tom, what was your idea?
It was a jump to conclusions, Matt.
Samir looks like he's almost in pain. Tom expands on this description. There would be different conclusions written on the mat
that you could jump to.
Tom is so excited about this idea. He's the only one. Peter and Michael both sigh. They can't even make eye contact. Bolton says it's the worst idea he's ever heard in his life. So maybe they haven't heard this one before, or maybe the cutdowns are a standard part of Tom telling the story.
Yes. Yes, it's horrible, this idea.
Tom is unfazed by the critique. He checks his watch and says he's got to get back to work.
If I still have a job.
Peter has given this idea of making $1 million a lot of thought.
Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work.
Whatever you said you'd do when you didn't have to work should be the thing you choose to do for work.
So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
Peter says he never had an answer for this question of what he'd do if he didn't have to work, which might be why he wound up working at Initech. Michael disagrees. He's over at the printer when he says the question is...
Bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean shit up if they had $1 million.
Smear thinks if he had $1 million, he'd go for some conservative, low-risk investments. Michael tells him he's missing the point. The point is to figure out what you do with your career. As he's saying this, the printer beeps.
PC load letter? The fuck does that mean?
This line was also not scripted. It's another Dave Herman ad-lib. He actually had more lines in this scene and was supposed to say something to Ron Livingston. In the middle of the scene, the printer really did pop up an error, which read PC load letter. The Samsung printer they're using was asking the user to check the PC or printer cartridge and load it with letter-sized paper. Herman reacted in the moment and in character to the error for another hilarious ad-lib, which included knocking one of the feeder trays to the floor. We cut to the exterior of Peter's apartment complex. There's a joke here. It's a bit subtle and very junior high. These are the Morningwood apartments. If you didn't chuckle at that, let me explain, delicately. It is a common occurrence for the male of the species, especially those in their 20s, to awaken each morning in a state of arousal. This is sometimes referred to as morning wood. Get it? Moving on. Peter enters his apartment dejectedly and has a seat on the couch. Suddenly, we hear a voice.
Hey, Peter, man! Check out Channel 9! Check out this chick!
The voice is coming through the wall?
Damn it! Lawrence, can't you just pretend like we can't hear each other through the wall?
Yeah, through the wall. Lawrence apologizes and asks if Anne is over or something. He was wanting Peter to check out some woman on Channel 9.
If you want to talk to me, just come over.
We cut to an exterior look at the landing between Lawrence and Peter's apartments. These scenes are being shot at 10610 Moreto Circle in Austin, Texas. These are the Great Hills Apartments. The reason they chose this particular complex is because of the placement of the outside doors. The producers liked the idea of the entry doors being so close together. It indicates the apartments are small and would share the common wall behind Peter's couch. Interestingly, the main entrance to the Great Hills Apartments wasn't right for camera. The Morningwood sign and entrance we saw at the top of the scene was actually shot at another Austin apartment complex called the Trails of Walnut Creek. Lawrence quickly crosses to Peter's door.
Hey, man. Check this out, dude.
He clicks the remote through the channels of Peter's standard def television, stopping on a shot of a topless woman giving herself a breast exam.
Oh, jeez, Lawrence.
Lawrence figured Peter would want to see it. This is 1999. Nudity on TV was not as common unless you paid extra for premium cable channels. Streaming Game of Thrones levels of nudity for $8.99 a month was still several years in the future.
Well, I'm sorry, man. I thought you wanted to see this.
For the second time in 3 minutes, Lawrence mentions Anne.
Doesn't that chick look like Anne?
Peter says, yeah, a little bit, but he's not thrilled about watching this very clinical process happening on his TV. Lawrence doesn't seem to get why this would not be appealing. Boobs are boobs, right? Mentioning Anne reminds Lawrence, where's she been? He's noticed she hasn't been over in a while.
Are you two still going out?
Peter says, yeah, I guess. Then...
I don't know.
This does not sound like a strong foundation for this relationship. This next bit sounds even less like a good basis for a relationship.
I don't know. Sometimes I get the feeling like she's cheating on me.
Yeah, I get that feeling too, man.
Lawrence has no filter, but he does tell it like it is. The mulleted and mustachioed man playing Lawrence is none other than comic actor Diedrich Bader. You might not recognize him with all the hair, but this is the same guy you remember from all 233 episodes of The Drew Carey Show. Actually, he is the only other performer besides Drew to appear in all of the episodes. Fun fact, you remember his character name on Drew Carey was Oswald? They didn't say it often, but the character's full name was Oswald Lee Harvey. Both Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn read for the Lawrence character, but were passed over. Casting director Nancy Klopper said Diedrich just brought something special to the role. The 6'2 Bader was born Carl Diedrich Bader on Christmas Eve of 1966 in Alexandria, Virginia. Why not perform as Carl Bader? I couldn't find confirmation, but I think it's because a producer was already using the name Carl Heinz Bader, spelled the same way. The union likes to make sure all members are registered with a unique performer name. At the age of 2, Bader's family moved to Paris, where he was raised until high school age. Diedrich's been performing professionally since doing a TV movie in 1988. He has over 230 credits on his IMDb profile, but more than half of those are for voice work on animated series. Watch for Diedrich in an upcoming live-action TV movie called Blind Psychosis, which is currently in post-production as of fall 2023. Peter wants to know what Lawrence means about the cheating comment. He says it's just a feeling he has, just looking at her.
She's the type of chick that just...
He trails off and shakes his head. Lawrence suddenly realizes how distressing this must be for Peter.
You know, I'm talking out of my ass.
Peter tells him not to worry about it. He's just had a rough day. Lawrence commiserates. He says he's had to be up at 6 every morning this week. He's doing the drywall at the new McDonald's in Las Colinas. There's a mixed-use planned community in Irving, Texas called Las Colinas. I wonder if he's working over there. The character of Lawrence was inspired by a neighbor Mike Judge had while working as a software engineer. His neighbor was an auto mechanic. Judge said he really seemed to enjoy his life and his work. He also made a lot more money as a mechanic than Judge did as an engineer, and he seemed to have a ton of leeway when it came to his schedule. Judge said he was always very jealous of this guy's autonomy and the way he actually enjoyed what he was doing. Peter and Lawrence inhabit two different worlds when it comes to work. Peter decides to see if any of the customs carry over.
When you come in on Monday and you're not feeling real well, does anyone ever say to you, sounds like someone has a case of the Mondays?
Lawrence pauses to contemplate the question.
No.
As he considers what Peter's asking, he gets even more demonstrative.
Shit, no, man.
Lawrence leans forward. The reality of what Peter is saying is starting to sink in, and it's not okay.
I believe you get your ass kicked saying something like that, man.
Peter realizes this Mondays thing might be a cubicle dweller's cross to bear. Lawrence wants to know if they're still on for fishing Saturday. Peter's sure Lumberg's going to ask him to work on Saturday.
He can get out of that easily.
Peter wants to know how. Lawrence very logically says he should duck out a few minutes before the end of the day. The boss will always grab you right at the end of the day to ask for the extra shift, so don't be there to let him.
I'll last a few hours on Friday. Duck out early. Turn off your answering machine. You should be home free, man.
Well, of course. Peter feels so doomed and helpless in his situation, he couldn't even come up with something that simple.
That's a really good idea.
Peter is hangdog. He and Lawrence sit with a couple of fresh beers. Peter continues the conversation from work, asking what Lawrence would do with $1 million. He doesn't hesitate for a moment.
Two chicks at the same time, man.
Peter laughs, thinking it's a joke. Oh, no. Lawrence is very serious. He's always wanted to do it, and he figures a guy with $1 million would be able to make something like that happen.
Because chicks dig dudes with money.
Peter says not all chicks are swayed by money. Lawrence agrees, but he knows his audience.
Well, the type of chicks that double up on a dude like me do.
Good point.
I love Lawrence so much. No nonsense, no illusions. You always know where you stand with a guy like Lawrence. Lawrence asks what Peter would do with $1 million.
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
Lawrence is a little surprised at this. Peter swears, nothing, just sit around. Lawrence astutely observes, you don't need $1 million to do nothing. Look at his cousin.
He's broke, don't do shit.
It's hard to argue with his logic.
Two chicks at the same time, man.
We cut to Peter in bed trying to get some sleep. Nina's phone answering voice is still echoing in his brain. He covers his head with his pillow. The shot dissolves to a watch face. This is a Bel Air watch. Bel Air is an affordable timepiece. They've been assembled in New Jersey, made from Swiss parts since 1945. Bel Air's a nice watch, but it's not outrageously priced like a Rolex or a Patek Philippe. A nice men's Bel Air watch runs around $250. This one Peter's wearing was most likely a college graduation present and cost maybe $150. We can see it's Friday the 12th, about 10:35 a.m., today's the day Peter will have to bug out early if he wants to avoid being roped into working tomorrow. The minutes are dragging by as Lumberg is talking. All of Bill Lumberg's talk bits, especially his monologues, are dryly hilarious.
So you should ask yourself, with every decision you make, is this good for the company?
He waves at a huge vinyl banner hanging from the ceiling. In good old boring underlined Helvetica is the question, is this good for the company? They did go all out with a bold, light blue-filled font for the word company. Standing under the sign is, for my money, one of the funniest curmudgeons to ever step in front of a camera. It's John C. McGinley playing the hired gun, efficiency expert Bob Slidell. We'll meet him in a few minutes. Tom and Peter are having a good look at Bob.
Is that the guy?
Yeah.
We're screwed.
Tom is such the optimist. Lumberg then introduces Bob in the most Lumberg way possible. He ums and hums until finally...
Yeah, Bob is a consultant.
Don't be afraid, little engineer. Bob's just going to be asking some questions and seeing how to make things run a bit more smoothly around here. Slidell is solemnly nodding along. Nothing is said about firings or downsizing. Slidell gives old Bill a big thumbs up.
Oh, and remember, next Friday is Hawaiian Shirt Day.
Woo-hoo! Sound a little like the Melon Bar Refiners? There is absolutely no response to this announcement.
So, you know, if you want to, go ahead and wear a Hawaiian shirt and jeans.
Still, zero response. Cut to a down-angle shot of Milton later that day in his cubicle. There are more boxes and papers stacked in his space. He is also located right below the Is This Good for the Company banner. Milton's on the phone, complaining as usual. It's the same litany of grievances. Chief among them, stop moving his desk or he'll quit. He used to be over by the window.
You know, and I could see the squirrels, and they were married.
Without a pause or transition, he starts in on how they switched from the swing line to the Boston stapler. At this mention, Milton raises a red swing line stapler to his chest, almost like he's cuddling it. We need to pause here and take a closer look at a couple of Milton's props. First off, those glasses. Milton in the shorts had glasses, but we didn't get the idea Milton was so horribly nearsighted. For the live-action version of Milton, he is very corrected. The lenses in Milton's glasses were so thick, Stephen Root had to wear contacts to counter the correction in order just to see. He says while wearing the contacts, he didn't have any depth perception. He was glad the stapler was red so it was easier to see to grab. Which brings us to the second prop I want to discuss, Milton's red swingline stapler. This is an epic tale. The stapler itself was a key plot point in the Milton shorts. It being red and a swingline were details added for the live-action version of Milton. At the time, swingline did not make a red stapler. They had previously made a red mini stapler, but never a full-sized red version. So why, if it wasn't red in the shorts, did they decide it had to be red in the movies? The only explanation I've seen says it's red because Judge wanted it to pop on screen. Being a swing line was not a deal-breaker. They also approached Boston and Bostitch. Neither made a red stapler and both declined to allow their names to be used on the product. Swingline said fine, but they didn't have a red swingline stapler to give the production. Here again, there are competing stories as to how the red stapler was created. Everyone agrees it started as a standard black swingline stapler. Then, either the props department picked up a can of red spray paint, or Judge had a friend with an auto body shop there in Austin shoot it with red auto paint. Either way, when this movie was made, this was the only red full-size swingline stapler that existed anywhere in the world. It took a few years, but by 2003, swingline had been inundated with so many requests for a red stapler, they decided to produce one. 20 years later, you can still purchase the classic swingline 747 Red Rio for about $15 from Walmart or Amazon. Don't forget staples. According to Milton, the swing lines don't bind up as badly. Stephen Root says to this day he has fans who will send him red staplers. He's also arrived on the sets of both movies and TV shows to find one or even sometimes a case of red staplers have been given to him as a welcoming gift. As Milton keeps talking, the camera is moving out of his cubicle. It's wandering on a crane shot over to Peter's cubicle. Hey, look, Peter's also on the phone. Oh, I see. Peter's on the phone with Milton. I did kind of wonder when we first cut to Milton, who exactly is he talking to? Peter's in a rush, cleaning off his desk. He has the phone receiver tucked under his chin as he's getting ready to leave. It's almost time. Peter checks his watch. It's 4:45. He's got to get out of here before Lumberg sticks him with work tomorrow.
I'll set the building on fire.
Okay, well, that sounds great. I'll talk to you later, all right? Bye.
When Peter stands, he can hear the distinctive yeah of Lumberg. He spots him over by the entrance to the bullpen. Peter panics and drops back into his desk chair. Peter still has to close down his workstation. He selects quit from a drop-down menu. A file copy dialog opens saying tables are being saved to disk. There's a progress bar and an hourglass. Much of Peter's operating system looks very Mac-like, but they don't entirely commit to these being Macs. Later, when the boys are transferring Michael's virus program, they will be copying from a C prompt, which is a very PC, DOS, Windows kind of thing. Checking back with his saving window, yeah, that looks like an old Mac. Peter is nervously tapping his desk, waiting for the progress bar to complete. As soon as the tables save, another dialog box opens with another round of saving. Then the index has to be rebuilt. This is torture. Finally, the OS disappears, leaving a very MS-DOS-looking C prompt. It's done, and Peter can leave. He scans the bullpen. No sign of Lumberg. Peter is out of there.
Hello, Peter. What's happening?
Damn, Lumberg is at Peter's cubicle. He was mere seconds away from freedom.
I'm gonna need you to go ahead and come in tomorrow.
Bill wants Peter to be there about 9.
That would be great. Okay.
Bill doesn't wait for an answer. He just turns and walks away. You think he's off the hook, but Lumberg isn't through with him yet. Bill pauses in the aisle as he's walking away.
Oh, and I almost forgot. I'm also going to need you to go ahead and come in on Sunday, too, okay?
He explains they lost some people this week. Now Peter has to spend his weekend playing a little catch-up. Peter says, okay, he'll be in. He hates this crappy job, but he also needs it.
Thanks.
We cut to a sign outside of a stylish-looking clinic. This is the practice of Dr. Swanson, CCCHT. I could only find the meaning behind 2 of the 3 C's in the doc's credentials. CCHT, with the lowercase t, is the accepted designation for a certified clinical hypnotherapist. This does call into question the bona fides on that title of doctor. I found an online course where I, too, could become a CCHT in just 6 short weeks for the low price of only $3,800. Normally, any course of study that allows you to call yourself doctor takes a lot more time, money, and effort. The blue convertible with the white top is a Chrysler LeBaron. I used to have one just like it. This office exterior is located at 1010 West Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Austin, Texas. The Walter Southwest Company has occupied the building since 1996. We hear Peter talking about work as we cut to inside the doctor's lair. It's Friday night. Peter would rather be at poker, but instead, he's sitting in a wildly patterned chair at the hypnotherapist's office. A thin, pinch-faced woman is sitting in another equally ugly chair to Peter's left. She's looking on with concern. This is Peter's girlfriend, Anne. She's the one we've heard so much about who may or may not be cheating on Peter. Anne's being played by comic actress Alexandra Wentworth. In recent years, she is also regularly credited as Allie Wentworth. Alexandra has started her performing career as a regular on the Fox TV series In Living Color. She appeared in 57 episodes of this groundbreaking variety show from 1992 until 94. Alexandra has 30 performer credits. She also had memorable turns as a guest on Seinfeld and in the movie Jerry Maguire. Allie has another unique credit in her bio. In 2001, she married political pundit, producer, and performer George Stephanopoulos. As much as we hear about Anne, this is the only scene in the entire movie where we actually meet her. We will hear her voice in a bit, but this is it for seeing Anne. Peter is explaining his depressing situation. He says every single day of his life is worse than the day before.
So that means that every single day that you see me, that's on the worst day of my life.
A heavyset man wearing a green shirt, brown vest, and really bad toupee is sitting across from Peter. This is Dr. Swanson. He asks Peter if today is the worst day of his life.
Yeah.
The doctor can't control his reaction to this statement.
Wow, that's messed up.
Dr. Swanson is being played by comic actor Michael McShane. McShane was born in Boston in 1955. His first big screen appearance came in the 1988 feature Tucker, The Man and His Dream. His first named role was as Friar Tuck in the 1991 Kevin Costner feature Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. McShane has 88 IMDb credits, primarily TV series and voiceover work. It looks like he's still working. Those credits include an NCIS appearance in 2022, and he provided a voice for a podcast series in 2023. And shoots the doctor a look over his messed up comment. He apologizes and tells Peter to go on. Now, Refiners, we talk about these Origins episodes as being inspiration for Dan Erickson. I think this next line is a bit more than inspiration. It's darn near an outline.
Is there any way that you could sort of just zonk me out so that, like, I don't know that I'm at work in here?
He points to his head. Peter, we'd like to tell you about an exciting new program being offered by a company called Lumen. We think they might be able to help you out. So as Dan Erickson is frantically scribbling down this line and thinking, hey, that might make a good premise for a TV show or something, Peter continues.
Could I come home and think that I've been fishing all day or something?
This sounds like a severance chip upgrade. Instead of just switching off for the day, you'd instead be fed some pleasant alternate memories, which is also sounding a lot like The Matrix. Mike Judge should be getting story by credits all over the place. The doctor chuckles. Making people think they've gone fishing really isn't what he does.
However, the good news is, I think I can help you.
Sure, if I've learned anything from a lifetime of watching sitcoms, it's that the quacks always believe they can help. Old Doc Swanson turns down the lights and tells Peter to relax. He then goes into standard hypnotist patter. He is taking Peter deeper and deeper into relaxation.
All your cares and concerns are disappearing.
Peter's face goes slack. He is concentrating on the doc's words.
Deeper and deeper, way down.
This is what you learn when you get that CCHT certification. This is also what I learned watching the professor accidentally hypnotize Gilligan.
Your concern about your job melts away.
As the doc continues to take Peter deeper and deeper into sleep, he looks a bit distressed.
Now when I count backwards from three, you will be in a state of complete relaxation.
Peter's eyes are closing. Doc's not looking so great. There's a sheen of sweat on his forehead.
Your worries, cares, and inhibitions will be gone. And you'll remain in that state until I snap my fingers.
We are cutting in closer and closer to the doc's now very sweaty face and shoots the doctor another look.
Way, way down. Two.
And might be mad. Swanson's counting Peter down. He gets to two, then...
One.
The doctor falls violently out of his chair. We get an overhead shot as he crashes to the floor.
Oh my God, Dr. Swanson!
Anne and the other couple who were also in the session jump to the doctor's aid. Peter, who had just been taken to the deepest levels of relaxation and not brought out, doesn't move. He stays seated, a very passive grin on his face, his eyes still closed. The other man in the session is bent over the doctor's face, checking to see if he's breathing. Things don't look good for Doc Swanson. The camera tracks over from Swanson to Peter. We can hear echoed voices asking if anyone has called 911. Peter hears a snippet of Hawaiian music and regards the scene with a passive grin. For the first time since we've met him, Peter looks genuinely happy. As the scene cuts to a clock radio, it's time to shut things down for this week, Refiners. Just meeting everyone has eaten up a lot of today's session. Next time out, Peter's new hypnosis-created attitude kicks things around Initech into high gear. We'll meet the Bobs, we'll find out about Michael's Superman 3 computer virus, and we're gonna burn this joint to the ground, literally. That's next time when Severed Origins finishes breaking down one of Dan Erickson's inspirations, Office Space. In the Audi world, things seem to be getting closer and closer for a season 2 of Severance. The writers have formally ratified their new contract, and they are back at work. We had our first new Saturday Night Live in 5 months last Saturday. SAG-AFTRA, the actors' union, is still out. Latest word is that negotiations between the studios and the actors' union have broken down. We know a lot of the second season of Severance had been shot prior to the writer's strike. They only had about a month left on a 6-month shoot schedule. Optimistically, if most of the primary shooting was finished, they could move to post-production while waiting on the actors to return. I'll keep an eye on it and let you know if anything happens. Be watching the Severed Facebook page for the latest updates. And be watching your podcast feed. Next time, Refiners, we will wrap up Office Space. Now it's time for you to exit via the elevator, and remember, as always, please stagger your exits.
You've been listening to Severed, the ultimate severance podcast. Severed is written, produced, and hosted by Alan Stair.
Severed is not endorsed by Red Hour Productions, Endeavor Content, or Apple TV Plus. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
Severance, the Severance logo, and all video and audio of Severance and Severance characters are registered trademarks of Red Hour, Endeavor Content, Apple TV Plus, or their respective copyright holders.
Please make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review for Severed at Apple Podcasts.